You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block. Ladies and gentlemen, the show you've all been waiting for, Second Chance Act. Okay, so let me, my little intro, and I'm going to give it over to Susan, of course. But I've noticed in the new directives, I've noticed in blurbs that the public information officers in D.C. craft as they describe the new director, they're kind of like Tweedledum and Tweedledee. First Step Act, Second Chance Act. You'll see them in the same sentence. Isn't that something?
That's wrong.
You see them in the same sentence, and so, wow, here we go again. But man, we've talked to this, and we will continue to talk about this until we're blue in the face or one of us passes away from a FSA heart attack. Just kidding.
We'll retire before then. Oh, I lost you. Bruce, you lost sound. Your mic. Nope, you are gone. Yep. We can just see your lips moving. So you know what? We're going to talk about the Second Chance Act. So we have been seeing, not only seeing on Facebook, we have been, Bruce is like incommunicado at the moment. So we've been seeing on the Facebook group, we have been seeing on phone calls, there is still a fundamental misunderstanding about the Second Chance Act. So we thought we would just do today's show is just a primer on the Second Chance Act. And we're going to start with talking about actually a very quick reference. If you don't have our book, Unlocking Federal Prison Authorities, Unlocking First Step Act, second edition, chapter 12, we actually added into the new content. Bruce, are you with us? Almost. So we actually added a whole chapter on the Second Chance Act, and we talk about the history and what was going on before and what were the issues. And a lot of the early 2000s was kind of that run up to the passage of the Second Chance Act back in 2007. So, you know, we're almost 20 years deep into the Second Chance Act. So there you are.
Okay. Sorry.
Carry All right. On.
Yeah, you're doing good.
Okay. So we are almost 20 years since the passage of the Second Chance Act. So, and with the First Step Act, there's this fundamental misunderstanding. You know, we all understand the First Step Act is earned credit. You have to do things to get it, right? Mm-hmm. The Second Chance Act is not about earning. The Second right. Chance Act, from its inception, has been about reentry needs.
Based on need.
Your mic is still slightly soft.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
I'll work on it.
You work on it. And I can hear me on your mic.
Okay. How about that?
You're even softer.
Even softer, huh? My goodness. Anyway.
Okay. We can hear you. You're just kind of soft. That's okay.
All right. Okay.
So Second Chance Act, it is a needs-based placement, right? I can't tell you how many times a day or week Bruce and I are talking to folks. We're responding to comments on the Facebook page. And we heard it this morning. He earned this. No, you don't earn the Second Chance Act placement. So let's start up, before we talk about what do we look at for Second Chance Act, let's just talk about what was the Second Chance Act. Back before then, there were two different issues. One, the Bureau was heavily focused on community safety. I mean, they paid attention to reentry, but heavily focused on that community safety. We are releasing individuals from secure incarceration into non-secure community environments. And we need to be concerned about that safety, right? So what was happening? Individuals from penitentiares, from mediums, they weren't going to halfway house. Rarely did you see someone go to halfway house, right? Why? Because they had really serious crimes. They were violent offenders. They were sex offenders. They were drug offenders involved in large-scale operations. If their offense, current offense, wasn't violent, they had a history of violence. So the Bureau said, you know what? We have to be concerned about public safety. Well, the ideas about things started changing. And in the interest of public safety, while the Bureau always talked about reentry, there was this push, this move toward reentry as part of public safety. After all, if someone successfully reenters, doesn't go back to leading a criminal lifestyle, doesn't go back to breaking crime and creating new victims, then the public is safer. Bruce?
Yes.
I didn't know if you wanted to chime in. You were nodding, and I'm in agreement.
No, but can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, that's a good victory. I love that you're differentiating. It's based on need. You are going to explain the five-factor review.
Yep, we're getting to that. Just kind of wanted to kind of set the stage of what it looked like before the Second Chance Act, where so many individuals were coming out of prison, and they were getting little to no placement. The other big thing prior to the Second Chance Act was all home confinement or halfway house. Let me back up. All pre-release placement was limited to 180 days. That was it. Even if you had been down for 20 years, you worked your way down to a lower facility, you had been out of the free world for a long time. The most the Bureau could do was 180 days. And that's how the Bureau kind of clicked along for several years. Going back into the early 90s, clipped along just fine. Well, in early part of 2000, in the 2000s, the OLC, that is an office within the Department of Justice, within the Attorney General's office, said, oh my gosh, Bureau, you are doing this wrong. Because the language regarding pre-release placement, halfway house, and home confinement was essentially one sentence. And that one sentence talked about halfway house and home confinement together. And there was this limitation on home confinement to 10% of the sentence or 180 days, whichever was less. The Bureau interpreted that one sentence to mean that we could put you in halfway house up to 6 months, 180 days, and whatever your 10% was, if it was less than 180 days, that's where home confinement was limited to. We could put you in the halfway house for 4 or 5 months, but if your home confinement eligibility was only 90 days, then you sat in the halfway house. This OLC memo came out around 2003, I think, and said, nope, Bureau, you have misinterpreted. Every person releasing is limited to 180 days or 10%, whichever is less. That was huge. It literally undercut everything the Bureau had been doing to date. 10%. There was no, let's look at the person. What are your needs? You know, do you have a job? Do you not have a job? Do you have a home? It was 10%. That's it.
That's it.
Or 180 days, the lesser of the two. So there were lawsuits filed. The Bureau was like, hey, our hands are tied. Maine Justice says we can't do it. So that created that kind of debacle over Maine Justice coming back and saying, no, you can't. That is what was some of the impetus, along with a growing understanding that folks are coming out of prison. And the more we can do to work with that transition and put them on a good start to the best of our ability, the better chance, the lower the risk that maybe they're going to go out there and not come back. But the bulk of the focus was on the community side. There was some focus on reentry at the institution side, but the bulk of it was halfway house. So what happened? Well, they passed a law, and I'm going to read right from the law itself. In general, the director of the Bureau of Prisons shall, to the extent practical, ensure that a prisoner serving a term of imprisonment spend a portion of the final months of that term, not to exceed 12 months, under conditions that will afford that prisoner a reasonable opportunity to adjust to and prepare for reentry of that prisoner into the community. Such conditions may include community corrections facilities. The issue was with the OLC memo was they said halfway house is not a correctional facility. Therefore, it is subject to this 10%, not this broader full 6 months. So Second Chance for the Bureau did two things. One, well, a couple things, but first off, it extended halfway house pre-release placement from 6 months, 180 days rather, 180 days out to a full 12 months. That was big. But the second thing it did was it specifically separated halfway house from home confinement. The home confinement paragraph, if you're really excited, it's 18 USC 3624 C1 is in general pre-release placement, and C2 is home confinement authority. By defining pre-release placement that included halfway houses specifically, separate from the home confinement requirement, it clearly delineated Congress's interest in giving the Bureau the ability to put someone in halfway house for a longer period of time with home confinement defined separately. That was huge.
Huge.
That's what we're dealing. That's what this whole, and everything worked fine until the passage of the First Step Act. And we talked about that last week with the issue that we were dealing with and what the new rollout of the conditional home confinement calculator is net. What they have been doing is that 10% date was calculated. The person had a projected release date, and that 10% or 180 days, the lesser of, was then attached to that projected release date. So if an individual was releasing in, pick a month, in August, they potentially, that and if they had a long enough sentence, then sometime in the February before the February earlier in that year, they would then be eligible, not guaranteed, not given, not a right, eligible for home confinement. But they were also eligible for that full 12 months going back a full year prior to their projected release date. And everything was easy peasy because we only had one release date that we had to deal with. Even for RDAP cases, right? Once you got in the RDAP program and it was determined you were eligible for 3621E release, they did the calculation and lo and behold, here's your date minus a year. And then you still got
your RRC and your community transition, but they'd have a date. There was multiple dates. You had a 3621E conditional date.
But the conditional date and the 3621E release date didn't appear at the same time. In fact, your release date wouldn't appear at all until you completed RDAP, your unit team filled out that paperwork, that transfer referral. It went out to the reentry office. They gave you a date, and then they took that date and they went, okay. And depending on what the person was looking at, how much time the person had between when they completed RDAP and when that 3621E conditional date was, they might go on Monday. We have a person that we're working with that literally finishes up on Friday and Monday he's transferring that fast. Others don't have as much because they've got this longer lead time between when they release and when they finish and when they release. Then only then does the conditional release date change to the release date because we've got everything in place. Another form is done, sends it off to Grand Prairie, and now we convert from a conditional release date to a 3621E release as opposed to 3621E conditional. It was all easy. There was only one date at any given time that the unit team was dealing with. It was either a good conduct date, it was a 3621E conditional release, or the 3621E release date. All of that went out the window with FSA. But we're not talking FSA. We're talking Second Chance Act. So now what else did the Second Chance Act do? The Second Chance Act said halfway houses are correctional facilities. And they said, Bureau, you need to be designating individuals to halfway house consistent with your designation authority. And the designation authority is found in, for all you legislative folks, 18 U.S.C. 3621 B is the section, place of imprisonment. That is the basis how the Bureau has the authority to designate someone who is committed to the custody of the Attorney General into a Bureau facility.
And this was part of the Crow situation?
No. This was the Crow thing just said, yes, the Bureau has this authority,
right?
Which was really exciting. That's what we were talking about last week. But from the Second Chance Act perspective, the Bureau now needed with every single inmate, and it talked about individualized consideration. You have to look at each inmate individually and make a recommendation consistent with what the Bureau refers to as the five-factor review. Now, if you pull up the Second Chance language, the actual statute, nowhere in there are you going to have to find the words five-factor review. It doesn't exist, okay? But what they're referring to, and they make reference to this section of the 3621B, which is the Bureau's authority to designate a place of incarceration. And so within that is these five very special factors.
There we go.
And we're going to share them. Again,
all right.
Resources of the facility contemplated. Nature and circumstances of the offense. History and characteristics of the prisoner. Any statements by the court any statements by the court that impose the sentence concerning the purpose for which the sentence of to imprisonment was determined or to be warranted, recommending any type of penal or correctional facility as appropriate. So what are we talking about there? We're talking about judicial recommendations. What did the court say at sentencing that they wanted the Bureau to be aware of? Okay. And then the fifth one, and there's not a whole lot of this, but it's still included because it's part of, again, the general authority of the Bureau to designate, is any pertinent policy statements issued by the Sentencing Commission pursuant to Section 994A2 of Title 28. Okay, very few, that rarely comes into play. But the first four, judicial recommendations, history and characteristics of the prisoner, nature and circumstances of the offense, and resources of the facility contemplated. Now, we're going to save the resource for the end. Let's talk about nature and circumstances of the offense. What is the Bureau looking at?
And we're talking about the instant offense here, not talking about prior
conduct. We're talking about the current offense. The person is in prison for what offense? What are they in prison for? Are they in prison for a violent offense? Are they in prison for a drug offense? What were the circumstances of the offense? Were they a low-level drug dealer? Support and habit? Or were they a street level organizer? Did they have people they report to? Were they running a ring in their neighborhood? Were they running a multi-state ring? Were they running an international ring? Were there weapons involved? Did people get hurt? What were the offenses? So when you're thinking about that, what you're looking at and thinking about is that whole first section of the PSR, when they talk about charges and convictions and nature of the offense conduct, right? Those enhancements, serious bodily injury.
924C.
924C. But within the 924C, because we're not talking FSA right now, are we talking about a 924C where there was actual physical injury to a person?
Right. Good point.
Was there actual threatening? Was somebody brandishing a weapon?
What was the role of that weapon? Yeah.
Was the weapon just in the car? You know, was the weapon in the car when the drug deal was made, or was the weapon on the person and they brandished it or they discharged it? Like, what was those circumstances, right? It's not just there was that conviction. What other kind of sentencing enhancements are involved? Were there vulnerable victims? Did you abuse for our white collar folks? Did you abuse a position of authority? Were you in a trusted position? And you were able to accomplish your offense because of your trusted position? Did you have vulnerable victims? Did you have elderly victims? Did you have child victims? You know, those are all relevant conduct, right? So that's the first thing that's looked at. History and characteristics of the prisoner. Now, this encompasses a lot. Is not a lot of stuff. This is not only your criminal history. This is your institutional adjustment.
Oh, so if you have a lot of if you got a 200 or 100 series incident report in the last year, does that affect it?
That is going to affect it. And the reason is simply this. And I used to say this. I spent 11 years working in a penitentiary as a case management coordinator. And once a month, I did admission and orientation. And I had to talk about halfway house. And this was before FSA kicked in. I was up in D.C. and regional office in D.C. by the time FSA rolled around. But when I was talking about the Second Chance Act, I said, Congress in their infinite wisdom decided that even if you're releasing from a penitentiary, we need to be looking at you for halfway house, for pre-release transition. Absolutely. And that's a great thing. But if you cannot stay out of trouble for more than 30 seconds here, how can I, in good conscience, send you into the community where now you not only have all the bureau rules, which you can't follow here,
right,
all the halfway house rules, and all the laws of normal society? So, yeah, so conduct is one. Programming is one, right? What programs have you done if you are a sex offender? Nobody likes to talk about sex offenders, but you're a sex offender. And during your time, you stayed out of trouble. You completed maybe the residential or the non-residential.
Residential or non-residential.
Yep. Sex offender treatment program. You had, what are the plans, Bruce, about what you're, like the behavior plans.
Yeah, the behavior plans.
The behavior plans, and you filed. You didn't even try to skirt the rules. You stuck to your behavior management plan. You did everything you were supposed to do. Is that person going to be looked at differently than the person who doesn't do any treatment, has a behavior plan that they don't follow, and they've gotten incident reports for it because they've tried to get things through the mail that they're not supposed to, mm-hmm. right? They're not doing any treatment and they've been problematic. How are we going to look at those two case examples? Are we really going to look at this person
FRP is a program, right?
FRP is a program. Yeah. FRP does mess you up. Again, not taking care of your bills is not demonstrating responsibility. And again, a person may be fighting on a restitution order. They may not like it. They may feel like they got gypped. Maybe they got an order that's jointly and severally owed. And that's always kind of a pain in the neck because you're responsible for everything, even though you're maybe have two or three people. We see that in white collar offenses, mm-hmm. but it's still part of your order. And if you're not taking care of it and you're in FRP refuse status, that's you thumbing your nose at the judge. And again, are we going to look at you to put you in a non-secure, open environment where you have access going in and out of the community when you can't do simple things like stay out of trouble, pay your bills, go to work, not escape? You know, that's what we're talking about. Basic things. But also within those characteristics, you know, so this is where release needs comes into play, right? When I used to talk about halfway house all the time, you know, clear conduct and doing programming doesn't necessarily get you more placement, but not programming and getting in trouble will definitely get you less, right? But what we look at within that line about characteristics of the individual, that's where we're talking about release needs. What does the person need? Because that's what the Second Chance Act was about. It was about expanding the amount of halfway house time and directing the Bureau that you got to look at more than security concerns. You know, if you think about that scale, the old fashioned scale with two trays on one on each side, right? We talk about that example. We're talking about FSA. I can't just look at community concerns. And Bureau was really good at safety and security. and looking at those security concerns for the local community, right? But they also got to look at the needs. They got to give the person a chance. And within Halfway House, within the Halfway House programs, they have the ability for even someone who has the needs, but maybe is a more, their offense or history is more serious. They can put them in a Halfway House program that's more restrictive, where they have less privileges. There they have to demonstrate that they can follow the rules, and then they get a little more leeway. You know, that community confinement kind of component of Halfway House is very restrictive. So those release needs. And when we start talking about release needs, okay, everybody has some needs, right? Even if it's nothing more than you need to go renew your driver's license and reactivate your car insurance so that you can drive, right? Everyone has some needs, but you've got really minimal needs. You have people that are going back to intact marital relationships, intact families. Maybe they've got jobs waiting for them. Maybe they don't have jobs. Maybe they're not going back to their job. We have some folks who have, you know, were able to go back to where they were working,
yeah,
you know, because it didn't involve, the offense didn't necessarily involve the work site. So they were able to go back to, their boss was holding a job, or they had enough community support between family and church and friends and neighbors that there were people helping them connect with employers. That's all super great. And then you have folks that have burned all their bridges. Right. You know, I can remember as a rookie case manager having a young man on my caseload in his early 20s, and he had been in so much trouble since the time he was just a little dude. His family didn't want him back. And I can remember thinking how sad that was. And, you know, we gave him as much Halfway House as we could. He had a very short sentence, so we couldn't do a whole lot with him. Reached out to probation, got him some public law placement. Like, I felt bad. Like, how much had you done by the time you were only 26 years old that nobody wants anything to do with you? You know, we have other folks who don't have a high school diploma. Maybe they got their GED in prison. Maybe they've never worked a legitimate job, because from the time they started earning money, they were earning it on the street, dealing drugs, whatever else they were doing, extortion, numbers, et cetera. So they don't know how. They learned how to work in prison. You got to get up. You got to report to your job detail. You got to have your work shoes on. If you're over in Unicorn, you got to bring your safety glasses, whatever the case was. That's a different person who needs more adjustment time, you know, or you have a situation where, because of the way the classification instrument is, maybe you started a penitentiary and you work your way down to a medium, but you don't have enough time because, you know, those criminal history points were really high that you're not even able to work down to a low, which is going to have a more open environment. It's not a camp, but it's certainly more open than a low. So now you're going to go from a medium security, or in the case where I was, a penitentiary, directly to the street. And so we're putting you in a Halfway House to give you some decompression time to literally for that transition. So those are some of the things when we talk about characteristics, history and characteristics of the person. That's what they're talking about. They're talking about their institutional conduct and their institutional adjustment, but they're also like, what are their release needs? Their release needs do not include, I want to go home sooner. Everybody wants to go home sooner. Like 30 plus years working in prisons, I have never met anyone who was like, oh yeah, I just want to stay here.
Right.
Because I like it so much. Everybody wants to go home.
Or there may
That's
be
not the, a release need.
Right. There may be the inmate next to you that isn't as good, or isn't, you know, maybe they're kind of a knucklehead, but it doesn't matter. And then you complain like, well, this guy got out, but I'm still here and I'm a better person than him. And or they virtue signal somehow. So wait a minute. That other person, you can't compare yourself to the next person. That's the first thing, right? Because they probably have different needs.
And I would argue that that guy who maybe who has been in and out of prison a lot of his juvenile and part of his adult life and is learning how to be a law-abiding a citizen, maybe they've stretched it out. Now they've got a few years of clear conduct and they've done some programming. But they've spent most of their years, they've spent more years in prison than out. Does that person need to be in a halfway house longer and get a longer runway to kind of land that plane? 100%.
Did you see some of that stuff at Lee? I mean, did you see these guys coming out after doing John Wayne time, getting some good halfway house placements, right? Based on need.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was an adjustment for the Bureau, right? Yeah. They were looking at, what do you mean we're going to put guys from a pen in a halfway house for 6 months was crazy in their minds, right? Like that was wild. Right. Like I will never forget this. One of my case managers had transferred from one penitentiary to another. And of course, now we're at Lee and the Second Chance Act has passed. And she was like, if I did one halfway house packet a year, that was a busy year.
Right, just because nobody was getting out.
They weren't getting out. They weren't getting placement. Now we were looking at individuals, and there were some growing pains there. I remember talking to a reentry manager who said, I don't care what their needs are. If they're a violent offender, they're getting 90 days. And I was like, well, that's not what the law says. That's what my warden is signing off on.
That's a bad cookie cutter rule. I know that.
That was that hurdle we had to overcome. It was a paradigm shift, to be sure, in terms of understanding that even dudes with, like, as you said, coming out of a penitentiary, they still have needs. And if we have any hope, any aspiration that they are going to adjust and do good and do better than they did in their previous life, you've got to give them a longer runway.
Yeah. That I mean, I'm with you on that. I was at Butner one meeting. We had a lot of guys from Terre Haute that scored down miraculously to go to a medium and the buses were flowing. But anyway, but look, I'd give these guys as much as I could because they've been down so long and they needed that. So they needed the time in that, literally that transition into the community to get on their feet in several regards. So
I remember when we rolled out email for the population and there was a lot of people were like, oh my God, we're giving them email. I had folks in the housing unit that had been down so long, they were afraid to touch the computer keyboard because they were like, if I break it, I'm going to get an incident report because they didn't know. And Trust Fund had to kind of expand their employment, their employment group, and put two individuals in every single housing unit.
Right.
To teach these guys.
Right.
How to do an email.
How to make that transition.
How to access it. And honestly, when you consider like reentry, something as simple as being able to send an email.
Right.
Is huge.
And I know this, we're making a story very long. Mm-hmm. Long story, a little bit shorter, is those offender characteristics are numerous and that can really tip the scale on how much Second Chance Act that
or
person.
How little.
Or how little. How much.
Or how or, little. Yeah.
There's not much. Anyway, I got you.
Or how little they may not need it, you know, and then you're talking about that, you know, what we started doing prior to the First Step Act was it became very common, particularly with campers, with minimum security individuals, to refer them to direct home confinement alone. And that was all they got. And if that meant they were in home confinement for 36 days, that's what they got. And that was it. And they weren't going to take up the halfway house space. Okay. So we've talked about the judicial recommendations. Those are easy. Characteristics. That's a pretty broad topic. Let's talk about resources of the facility contemplated. This is where
all you need to do is get a track phone for $10. Now, come on, what's going on?
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. So, Bruce, you spent much time in the community in the RRMs. How long does first off, like, how long does a new contract take?
Oh, okay. To make, first of all, to amend or change a contract literally almost takes an act of Congress. Folks, not only does the Bureau of Prisons have to adhere to what's called the Federal Acquisition Regulations, the JAR, but the Bureau has to adhere to another set, right, called there's judicial acquisition and then the federal acquisition. So you have two acquisition regulations to jump through. And it's really interesting because there would be people, let's say that we're going to give more home confinement spots to Halfway House A. Halfway House B wants to sue the Bureau because they didn't get, see what I mean? Then the Bureau has to jump through the hoops to say, whoa, we did this mandate analysis. We look at our census. We look at the pipeline, who's coming in. And we're just constantly being shot at for trying to get more beds, trying to get more people at home confinement because of other contractual things or other competitors that were felt salty or whatever. So
because they can, other bidders can contest a contract. So a contract with ease, like with no issues, can take upwards of 2 years.
Absolutely.
And then you have, well, this company also bid on and they didn't get it. So they want to contest the award. And if the award is contested,
it hangs it up. It can hang it up.
It gets hung up.
Hang up them awarding the new beds or whatever, the modification. So, and I know, folks, that's frustrating. And this isn't a cop out. These are facts. Like, hey, there's a new directive. Hey, the new director wants this. Absolutely, he wants it. And they want to do it. And we have a new calculator because you don't have to pay outside people for a conditional calculator, right? That can all be done in-house so you can assemble your team and you can get stuff done. Well, not this other stuff. Back in the day, we used to have the community treatment centers and the BOP owned their own halfway houses. We wouldn't have some of these problems today if that was still the case. But no, we outsourced those to community providers, right? Nothing wrong with that. It's just the way that it is. But what comes with that is a consequence of lots of shuffling, lots of paperwork, lots of different acquisitions, and then you got trained staff
the contractors don't have the same access to information that the Bureau employees do.
They don't.
So how often do we hear, well, I talked to my halfway house at the my case manager at the halfway house, and all they have is this date and this date. And we're like, yep, because they're the contractor.
Right. And so especially what we've all been dealing with, even our listeners, that's frustrating because these dates are moving. They're all moving targets, right? The more you earn, the more, okay, are you in 10-day status? Are you in 15-day status? It keeps moving. And yet there was none of this conditional calculator stuff there. So people are just doing stuff by hand. And you had inmate math, family math, Bruce and Susan math. But at least that part of that loop is now going to close. God, thank you, Jesus, that's going to close, you know, because all these dates will be kind of set up there. But now it's just the issue of
getting the referrals. Let's be clear. It's not that the institutions had bad information in the calculators. This was a new tool. This was another
brand new.
So just like they didn't have initially, they only were referring people based on what's the current FSA release date, because we didn't have the calculator yet for the conditional date. Then they started working with the conditional release date. Then they got the conditional placement date. Now we have more information. Now we have a condition. Well, they're calling it max home confinement, but essentially it's the conditional home confinement date because it's based on those conditional release and placement dates. These are more tools, but with more tools and more data, now the case managers, just like they were last year when the conditional placement calculator rolled out and they were inundated with new information, and information is good, don't get me wrong, But all of a sudden, folks that weren't even on their radar are now, I've got to do the paperwork. I've got 40 people that need paperwork right now. That's what they were dealing with. The same thing is going on now with the new information. Now they have information of, well, they're going to be a direct, they can have direct home confinement. We originally, we recommend it 120 to 150 days, but their conditional date is actually 160 days and they've got all this stuff in place. So I've got to go back and I've got to, because they don't really need the halfway house, but they had a longer sentence. So I was giving them, we were recommending more time, but they have a home to go to. Now I've got to go back, pull that paperwork back, contact the reentry office, or maybe the paperwork's partway through the institution and I got to redo it.
Right.
You know,
so let me ask you this question. Somebody with 12 months in a day or a super short sentence, I know, we know that all their time that's FSA goes toward their sentence. Are they going to get any FSA or not? Or they could.
You mean SDA?
Yeah. Second Chance Act. Sorry.
Right. Okay.
I mean, if they have a need, can they still get?
Sure. Okay. The problem is their amount that they can get is significantly less because it still takes time to get everything in the system, get the conditional calculator because everything's got to be loaded, get a date there. They start earning credit. Now, just to get the halfway house, right? Just to get a halfway house date, there is a packet. And yes, it's easier than when you and I were doing things because it's all digital now. But I still have to write a progress report. I still have to do the supervised release plan. I still have to do the 210 referral. What's gotten easier is I'm not going to the photocopy machine with the central file and making copies to PSRs and JNCs. I'm clicking buttons. So the automation has enhanced, it sped up parts of the process. And then once it starts moving through the department, it's not a paper file walking through for people to sign off on. As soon as I click the button, it moves to the next person. So things are moving along. Automation has been really, really helpful, just like these conditional calculators. But a person with only 12 months and a day sentence, maybe they get 60 days, maybe 90 days, if they have really serious needs. Right. If they don't, and they just like this, they're going back to the home they were in before, they might just get a direct home confinement placement.
Right.
36 days.
Right. That's true. That's true.
Yeah. And now we've got good date information with the new calculator is that case manager can make that recommendation, do that paperwork and get that date as opposed to trying to figure out what it's going to be.
Right. So yeah, if you don't have a home to go into, or that doesn't seem very clear to your case management staff, right? That's why these plans, we had a client, we still have him, and the parent is like, okay, do you want to live in this town or do you want to live in this town? You know, what's your plan? Remember that? And the guy's like, my plan is to get out.
My plan is to go to halfway house. No, you got to do a little bit more than that.
That's not a plan.
That's not a plan.
A plan. To maximize these resources, we need to have, sort of articulated plan that's coherent.
He had been down a long time, and some of the circumstances had changed. But, you know, as I like to remind some of our parents, because we work with a lot of parents, right, is their son or their daughter is still an adult and they got to like be an active participant in this, you know? So,
right. They got to advocate for themselves, show some independence. Yeah. I totally get it. But you know, the whole thing about, you know, just because I'm eligible doesn't mean I get it. Just because I want it doesn't mean I get it. Just because something is out there doesn't mean I can partake in it. In terms of particularly Second Chance Act stuff, because it's pretty subjective in some respects. Right.
And the law allows that. In fact, the law specifically says those decisions are to be made
at the discretion of the Bureau.
At the Bureau, but as an individual. So kind of comparing to the person in the other rack or in the other cell or you know, across the bay, you know, no one has your set of circumstances right. except you. There is no, you know, when I was a very young case manager and we didn't have the Second Chance Act, you know, we sort of started with, well, if you had 6 months or less to serve, you didn't get halfway house. So if you got somewhere between a year and 2 years, you were looking at like 30 to 60 days, you know, and then if you had 2 to 3 years, we'd look like 60 to 90 days. We kind of had a ballpark based on your sentence, where we were going to start. And then if you had a lot of needs, well, then you might go up from there. Or if you really didn't have any, you might drop down a little bit. But it, in a way, it was pretty formulary. I mean, it wasn't officially a formula, but like that's how I was trained as a case manager.
That, well, it also seems like we didn't have that much to give away. I mean, we had some months to give away, but it wasn't this.
It was very limited.
A year, yeah. But now, since it, you know, inmate sees I qualify for up to a year of SCA and I get all this other here on FS. And man, people are doing that wild math and they're stacking the years and we want to stack this and we want to front load and we want to get out tomorrow. It's like, hold on, you know, pump the brakes. Let's
pump
see
the
what's going on. Yeah.
So, but those resources and just kind of wrap that resources up. This has not, it. So yeah. We've talked about before, there's a contract capacity, there's staffing levels, there's equipment, there's bed space. There's also what resources they have. If you have someone who has a lot of medical issues, for example, if they're in an institution, they've got a clinical director, they've got a physician assistant, maybe a physician, maybe they got nurses. Halfway House has got nothing. You have a medical event at a halfway house, you're going by ambulance to the emergency room. There is nothing. So again, going back to resources, medical resources, mental health resources. We have some seriously in the Bureau. I mean, we have inpatient mental health units for seriously mentally ill individuals. Those are individuals that are social workers are literally working to find residential facilities for them to transfer to upon release, secure residential facilities for them to go to upon release because they are not capable of independent living. Those individuals are not going to go to a halfway house.
Right.
They have to have that secure.
You have to be medically cleared enough. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have to be medically cleared enough. Otherwise, I don't think the BOP wants to take on that liability of have somebody have some sort of huge medical event in a halfway house that they can't respond appropriately to, especially if
all
these
they
individuals,
can do is call for an ambulance.
Yeah, especially if they're coming from a medical center. And you and I were at a medical center for about 6 or 7 years. And I saw some of those ladies; they weren't medically clear. They couldn't, you know, they didn't want to.
They
take
couldn't
them.
Transfer. They weren't yeah. healthy enough.
They couldn't take them into a halfway house. I mean, as much as we wanted to, but I mean, I did see a couple get through that were astonishing.
Well, and we looked at, you know, if they had that family support, there might be the opportunity for home confinement. And, you know, if they had that support. But in a lot of cases, that wasn't the case.
All right. We're at about a minute.
Ooh.
Well, I was being a bad steward of time. All right. Closing thoughts. We'll pick up on this next week. Y'all keep asking questions.
Yeah, I was saying, why don't we have, if you're in the Facebook group, on YouTube, post some questions. We can talk more about this and some of the more, we'll talk some more about this. It's a hard thing to keep for folks to wrap their head around in terms of it's need-based and it's resource-based. And
all right, and we'll continue on that next time. Keep asking questions on the Facebook group. Keep asking questions on the YouTube channel. We'll answer them. Give us a holler. The phone number's posted all over the Facebook group. So you can see these shows on LA Talk Radio. You can also see them on Apple Podcasts and also Amazon Audible and a couple of other podcast aggregators. So thank you for listening and thank you for your patience. And we'll see everybody here next time.
on Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block.
Around the Block.
Take care, everybody. Have
Take
a great
care. Week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.